This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. It's your boy, Michael Cruz Kane, back again with another episode of A Good Cry. Thank you so much for listening. This is the season one finale, which is a little sad that season one is coming to an end, but on the up, season two is coming down the pike, and that's because you've been listening, sharing, subscribing, DMing, tweeting, etc. and so forth. Thank you so much for your support. It means so much to us. We're going to take a little hiatus. We're going to get all our ducks in a row. I don't know what that saying means now that I'm saying it out loud. Are the ducks lined up to go into an event of some kind? Are we shooting the ducks? We're not. Are we? I don't know. Okay, we're going to get our ducks in a row. We're not really going to think about it. And then we're going to have a season two. And in the meantime, I'm going to respond to every email, every DM, every piece of mail that was sent to my house. Just kidding. No one did that. And thank you for not doing that. I don't want you looking up my home address, I don't think, yet. Well, all right. Any hoots and hollers. This episode features my interview with the amazing Nora McInerney, who is an author, a public speaker. Is that a category of person? A podcaster. She's also a brilliant, lovely, smart, thoughtful, funny human being. And I find so much of what she says relatable in this episode, and I think you will too, for two reasons. One, she has been through very profound tragedy, so in that way, she and I relate. But also because she has a way of expressing herself and her grief that is relatable, I imagine, to anyone. And even if you haven't had any experience like the experiences that Nora and I have had, you will find things in this conversation that resonate with you. I'm going to get right to it because I love this episode so much and I'm excited for you to hear it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for making this a successful season one. And I love you. I mean, I love you. Enjoy. Thank you so much. Hi, Nora. We get our podcast started by asking, how would you describe your relationship with grief?
Oh, long-term, tumultuous, unstable, toxic.
Good.
One of the worst boyfriends I've ever had has got to be this grief, baby.
Wow, tough for the other boyfriends who are in competition with the grief, though.
It's tough. It's
to be one of the worst.
All the bad boyfriends I've had, this has got to be the worst one. And then, like all bad boyfriends, you have this moment where you think, huh, maybe he's not all bad. You know, he did remember how to say my last name once. I did learn something from him, right?
Sure.
I learned how to do a killer bong rip. It's not the kind of relationship. And God, now that I'm into this, I just can't stop. Hopefully you edit this.
But it's, absolutely not.
You don't pick these kinds of relationships. This is the kind of boyfriend, and I had several where all of a sudden I was like, oh no, we're dating. Oh, no. Now we have to be together as long as you want to be together because I don't know how to break up with somebody.
I don't know how to stop.
Yeah. Oh, no, you're a boyfriend. Oh, God. Okay.
I was watching. There's copious internet materials that you have produced over the course of your grief time. Mm. And I watched a lot of it just immediately prior to this interview. And this is really leading no place except to say that you're so brilliant and funny and make everything so true.
Thank you. I accept that compliment. I really do. That means a lot to me coming from a funny person. That's all I've ever wanted to be called my whole life.
I'm going to have trouble accepting your compliment, but I think the way you did it was great. Can you, for the people who aren't familiar with your story and your work, can you talk a little bit about your grief?
Yeah, it was non-existent for a long time. I had had some sort of brushes with it growing up, but nothing too difficult. You know, my grandpa was old when he died, and I was sad. And also, it just felt like, well, that's what happens, right? That's what happened. That's what grandpas are supposed to do. You know, I was in fifth grade. I thought, well, now I'm an adult. One of my uncles died tragically when I was in middle school. And I remember feeling very, very distraught about it and thinking, I must have this wrong because I didn't see anyone else cry after the funeral. I just didn't. And that was my mom's like little brother, one of my mom's baby brothers. And so I know it absolutely wrecked her, but we apparently kept things pretty much to ourselves emotionally. And I put that out of my mind and I had a nice little uneventful life. And I went to a college and then I moved to New York and then I got a job and then I had a mental breakdown and then I moved back in with my parents and then I got an apartment and then I fell in love and it was real and all of the most annoying people that you've ever met. I met this guy and it was just easy and wonderful. And like on our second date, Michael, we were talking about how many kids we wanted. Like wow. The kind of things, when it's the right person, things that would be a red flag with anyone else are totally acceptable. You know, they make total sense. You're like, oh yeah, of course. No, of course. Yes. You want two, I want four. I'll say three. I'll make a handshake agreement for three. Right. I'm pulling the goalie. We both know it. It was so wonderful. And we were together for a year. And truly, right after I moved in with him, I got a call at work from one of his coworkers. And we both worked in advertising. And this is 2011, before I think HR existed. Because his coworkers were always doing things like if you left your computer unlocked, they'd send an email to you. Everyone, you know, from you.
Sure. Yes. The frat boy era.
Exactly. The frat boy era of creativity where the frat boys were skinny. They were wearing skinny jeans and they had soft hands and small ironic t-shirts and, you know, work boots for jobs that required them to sit and click. steel-toed boots just in case someone, you know, rolls their chair back and jostles
you. In case you drop your mouse on your foot.
Yes. So when his coworker called me and asked if Aaron had ever had a seizure, I thought it was a joke and it wasn't. And so I went to the hospital and Aaron was in the ER. And when I walked in, he pretended to have a seizure and he got me. And we thought it was so funny, oh my Michael. God. We were like, I was like, oh my God, why are you at the hospital? What a loser. Like, come on. It's Halloween. We have to pass out candy. I'm 27 and I finally live with a boyfriend. I cannot wait to play house with you tonight. These doctors don't understand. We're going to pass out candy and wear like cute little costumes together. And the doctors did not understand, and neither did we. I should say the doctors did understand. We didn't. We right. thought it was no big deal. Men have seizures at work sometimes. Like, why are you making this such a big deal? Well, they were making it a big deal because he had a brain tumor that was growing on the right side of his head, right up front, and he needed to get it removed right away. And so 4 days later, he was having brain surgery. And a month later, we were married. And a year later, we had a baby because science is amazing. And our third wedding anniversary was Aaron's funeral because you just do not win against stage 4 brain cancer. You don't. And Aaron had died 6 weeks after my dad died of cancer because my dad just could not handle someone else getting all the attention. And in May, he was like, I also have cancer and I didn't go to the doctor because I'm a boomer and no one tells me, no one tells me what to do. And right 5 days before my dad died, I had miscarried our second baby at 11 weeks and 6 days. So my story could be summed up in 2 minutes, but instead I took approximately 9.
No, that story deserves a lot of space. Can I ask you, because that's like so much compounded grief. Like
it's so much.
So right on top of each other. Plus, I would imagine there's like a medium level anxiety all the time. Because
Which I didn't recognize at all, Michael, at all.
Well, I think it's like, it's sort of like this is water, right? Just like this, what do you mean I'm anxious? This is how to be alive. Mm-hmm. You're always, everybody's always worried that their husband's going to die from brain cancer, right? That's just like a normal thing people think.
And if they're not, they should be, because it's very common in white men 35 to whatever, or, you know, 25 to whatever. I refuse to learn anything from this experience medical-wise, by the way.
I do not want to be made better by this at all.
I don't want to be, some people just immediately get like a University of Google medical degree.
Sure.
And they're in the forums and they're downloading studies. I was like, No. I don't even want to know. He took, what kind of chemo did he take? I don't know. It was a pill. I couldn't tell you. None of my business. That's doctor work. My work was, you know, making sure we had Sour Patch Kids and for a weird period of time, making him drink green smoothies because I thought that would help.
That was, so your level of research was, that's where you were at. You were like, I think if I blend some kale, this could be.
It was major. It was the girl boss era. So I was like, I think that I could solve this with the right smoothie. I do.
My brother had cancer when I was a kid. He's survived. He's fine, except that he's Republican. But when he was in the hospital, my dad's a doctor and my mom is not. And my dad would come in with like, you know, here's what you can do. These are the things you can do to kind of mitigate the pain and X, Y, Z. And my mom would be like, you know what you got to do? You got to have orange juice. Every day it's got to be orange juice. And it's like, I don't think that's a thing. Even if that would help stop you from getting cancer, which I don't think it does. He has the cancer. It's now. It's happening now.
I was your mom. I really was. I was like, I saw a book cover about cancer, and I skimmed the inside, and that's where I got this smoothie recipe. So you're going to choke it down, and that is what you are going to do, and that is how we will survive this. But to your earlier point, Michael, I refused when people would say, oh, well, you're probably grieving. I had such a negative reaction to that word being used when Aaron was alive, and looking back, that was just misdirected anger and frustration because, of course, I had grief. I had just watched like the life that we were expecting to live together just sort of evaporate. I was grieving the loss of his normalcy, everything that he deserved out of life that his friends would still get, that, you know, his enemies would still get, that, you know, It looked everywhere around me were a ton of people on varying degrees of, you know, on the scale of good to bad. Like, you, everyone knows like some shitty people, and you're like, wow, that guy's going to live forever, I guess. Good for him.
Right. He's invincible.
Huh. Wonderful. But of course, I was grieving. And the interesting thing, too, is the people who said that to me were people who knew me and loved me. At no point do I remember any medical professional asking if I was okay. Or if I needed anything. And I went through that entire experience without a single mental health professional in my life at all.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, when you talk about like that experience, did you know he was going to die well in advance of when he died? Like, was it the kind of thing where it's like, this is going to happen at some point? Or was it, we're still hopeful that this will be cured?
It was both. There was this moment. There were so many things, and we were so foolish because we just didn't know. And so we were hopeful and we were young, and there were all these sort of hiccups in the system, like in the actual medical system, where Aaron got his brain tumor taken out on November 3rd, 2011. And then he had an appointment with an oncologist on November 17th. But before he could see the oncologist, he had to go see a general practitioner because he didn't have a GP. He didn't have a GP. And this had been a bone of contention, Michael, before I moved in. I was like, you have to be an adult. You have to have a doctor. How do you not have a doctor? You have to go see the doctor. And I remember him, like, you know, in the hospital being like, well, I saw a doctor.
Yeah. Plenty of doctors now.
Right. We had to go establish a primary care relationship. And we're sitting there in the lobby. And I noticed, like, okay, this is all part of the same health system. And the doctor walks in and he's, you know, a young little Irish guy. And I ask him, do you have access to the pathology report about the brain tumor? Because at this point, we were still thinking, well, brain tumors are benign all the time. Like, right. So we'll take that one. That'll be perfect. It'll be benign. And the guy froze and he said, I do, but you should wait to read it with the oncologist. And I had said to Aaron before, only an oncologist can tell you you don't have cancer, which I don't think is true. But I was like, if it was cancer, I feel like they would have told you like immediately, right? It would be a phone call. It would be something, right? I don't know. Why would they make you wait? I can't do the math of 17 minus 3. I think it's 14. There we go. Why'd they make you wait that many days to find out right. You have cancer? That seems silly. So I asked the doctor, I was like, well, just print it up and I'll bring it home. Just print it up. And he did it. And you could tell he didn't want to.
Yeah.
And when we were riding in the elevator, I looked at it and I saw the word glioblastoma. It, like, just of all the words on the page, and none of them made any sense. It was truly illegible the way these reports are written. My brain cannot comprehend things like that. That word floated up off the screen. And I took out my little iPhone 5 and I looked up that word and it said, right away, the life expectancy is 3 to 5 years. And that life expectancy has not changed in forever, ever.
Like to this day, it's the same.
To this day. And that was true 30 years ago. That was true 40 years ago. It was probably worse maybe 60 years ago. But that's life expectancy. And I thought, okay, well, that's for like most people.
Right.
That's yeah. But there's always some people who live forever. You know, there's always a person who lives 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And so we'll just be that person. That's what will happen. We'll be that person. And I didn't say anything to Aaron, but we went out to lunch and I just like choked down this hamburger and thought, oh God, like, oh, 3 years is not enough. Like 5 years is not enough. And then I thought, I will just live as though I never saw that word, as though I never, ever looked that up. And I won't let him look it up either. We won't do that. We won't have that. We don't need that negativity in our lives. And, but later that night, he used my phone and he said, why were you looking up cancer words? When we did see the oncologist, we told him right away, we told the nurse practitioner, we told the social worker, we told the whole team of people who sort of assemble around you, we don't want to know. Like, we don't want to know anything. Like, tell us what to do, but we don't need to know a timeline ever, even if you think he's about to die in 10 seconds. Like, we don't want to know. And I sort of siphoned off that knowledge out of my brain as much as I could and pretended like I didn't know and that he hadn't seen it either. And we did everything the doctor told us to. And, you know, we decided to have a baby. The doctors did not bring that up. Like, we brought that up right before he started chemotherapy because, you know, what if? Like, what if he did live 20 years? So I sort of have described it as like this sort of parallel track where like you live like the worst could happen and like the best could happen at the same time. And to this day, I think that was the most beautiful way to possibly live because I had an awareness of how bad things could be and an awareness of how good they were every moment that the worst thing wasn't happening. And so I do think those were the hardest years of my life. And also they've been, to date, still the happiest years because I had that much awareness.
When you talk about the happiness, are there moments in those years that, and I'm sure there are probably different moments that come back to you every day, but are there moments in particular that you're like, even though I'm in what many people would describe as, you know, it's like, it's hell. It's like this where the things you love can be taken away from you. You still have these moments of joy. Are there any that you remember specifically?
Yeah, everything that Aaron did, he made fun. Everything was fun. So I would forget. We would both be like, oh yeah, well, we're staying at the hotel tonight. Hospital. We're staying at the hospital tonight. Not because the hospital was nice. The hospital was like, we were on like an old crusty floor when his treatment changed and he had to go spend like three nights, you know, at a time in the hospital. But just every moment that we spent together always felt like we were doing something fun. When he got out of brain surgery, one of our favorite things to do together was just go to Target. This is the first man I ever was with who was like, oh yeah, hell yeah, I'll go to Target with you. Yes, I will browse. But he started every trip to Target by, you know, in the lobby of a Target. Is that what it's called? The entryway?
Like, yeah, the foyer.
Yeah, there's a set of doors and then another set of doors and then there's like a holding area. I don't know what it's for. And they've got a glass case where they put up that week's bulletin. And God help the generation like 30 years from now who's like, what? Why would you ever put up a paper? What? What's that? It like brings you back to being a kid, opening the Sunday paper and getting all the deals. And he would stop in the lobby of every Target and say, we got to check out the deals first. Like, we got to see like the lay of like what's on special right now. And then we'll go from there. And he was just being discharged from the hospital after having brain surgery. He had gauze wrapped around his head like he was an extra in a World War I movie with like blood seeping through a part of it. And he was like, let's go to Target. I was like, oh my God, yes, let's go to Target. I love this. And we went to Target and he stood with his big gauze helmet in the like lobby, looked for some deals. And we just shuffled through Target together. Well, he's on like heavy narcotics, has stitches like running the length of his skull and is missing a chunk of his brain. I was like, this is great. And I don't know, just we had like such a normal life. It's not like, I mean, we at one point in time when things were, you know, getting worse and, you know, we had a kid and the Belize Tourism Board sent us on a honeymoon to Belize, which was wonderful. And that was great, right? They're like, we know this sad couple. We're going to send them to Belize. Like,
thanks.
Right? That was great. That was wonderful. But like those sort of big moments aren't really like my favorite memories. It's just sitting on the couch, flicking through, you know, the Apple TV, picking something to watch, having a conversation about what you want for dinner. Like, it gave me such an appreciation for the mundane and any moment where things weren't like actively getting worse, where he wasn't, you know, having a seizure at the kitchen table or, you know, having neuropathy and losing feeling in his fingers and dropping things. Any moment where things were just okay was like absolutely wonderful. And he just made everything feel wonderful. Like he could be going through chemo and feel terrible. And I had all these lovely friends who just came to us instead. And I'd have a house full of like girlfriends on a Sunday afternoon. And he would always like get up and rally and like come out and make coffee for people and like, you know, take people's dishes and sit. And he was the kind of husband who could sit and not ruin a vibe. And I know there are women listening who know, like, they don't think it's their husband. No one ever does. But, like, everyone knows a friend who, when their husband enters the room, is like, party's over.
It's over.
Yeah, it's over. God, this guy sucks. And he thinks everything we like sucks. But really, he's the one who sucks. And Aaron was, like, the opposite. He was like, what are we talking about today? Is it Taylor Swift? I have opinions on 1989. You know, it was, yeah, like those kinds of moments, I think.
I mean, that's just a gift, I mean, to you, but to someone who can find joy in the midst of despair is like a gift to everyone around them.
Truly.
Because you don't even, I mean, I think it can be very hard for people to operate at all. And it, like you kind of are taking your cues from that person.
Yes, yeah. Are you that kind of person?
I mean, I try to be.
Yeah.
I don't, if you have to ask my wife, I guess, but I think that, you know, you need permission from the saddest person in the room for the person who's going through it to be able to laugh or feel joy, or, you know, and him, he's giving you and everybody else like the opportunity to be happy, even though something bad is happening.
Yeah. And I'm not naturally that way at all. And I'm just naturally like, oh, well, just Aaron had never been depressed ever. And I remember describing it to him and he was like, oh no.
It sounds so bad.
He's like, you just feel that way? Like all the time, like every day for just no reason. And I was like, well, yeah, like, you know, like what's the point? And like, should I get up? And he was like, oh God, like just. Like, could not relate. Was like, oh no, how do you make it turn off? Like, what are you going to do?
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You and Aaron have a son.
Yes, Ralph.
And how did you deal with this? For Ralph, like how did you talk about it with him? How do you still talk about it with him?
Still. And like this is, I have learned a lot. And Ralph was 22 months old when his dad died. And, you know, since then, I'm not an expert at all, but I've heard things, I've read things about, you know, inherited trauma and epigenetics and the way that, you know, our surroundings affect us even when we're too little to verbalize it. And Ralph was born 2 weeks after Aaron started this chemo that would hospitalize him, right? And not even 2 weeks. Like I was worried sitting in the hospital with him that I would go into labor and have to go down two stories and have a baby alone. And I just remember like that you can't clench a baby in. But I was like, I kept the core engaged. I kept, you know, I kept that pelvic floor locked. I was like, I'm not doing that. And you know, I think Aaron must have felt so shitty. And he still was there for the birth. He stood there. There were complications. He went up to the NICU with the baby. And, you know, Ralph's whole babyhood, I was home with him and I was home with his dad who had just had another brain surgery. Aaron's brain tumor came back and he had a brain surgery on December 26th and Ralph was born in January. In late January. So like, I was taking care of both of them while Aaron was also trying to help take care of me and take care of Ralph. And he was sort of born into this little universe where like we all need each other. And we also all know that like one of us has it worse and it's your dad. And I do think Ralph was a very verbal toddler. I think that kids have a very acute sense of the emotional landscape around them, even when adults aren't verbalizing it to them. Mm-hmm. And he was there when they brought in the hospice bed, and he was there laying in a hospice bed with me and his dad, and his daycare was next door, thank God for our neighbors. And so I sent him to daycare. Those last few weeks, just walked him next door in his little snowsuit. And the day that Aaron ended up dying, there had just been so many people at our house. And I just told everyone to stay home. And Ralph was wearing like overalls. Like, you know, little kids in overalls, just the cutest thing in the world.
Nothing better.
Like, and I didn't know it was going to be that day, obviously, and I hadn't said anything. And Ralph was standing at the edge of Aaron's bed, and he like climbed up, and he was so careful with all like, you know, the port and like the tubes and stuff. And he like laid there, then he kissed him, and he got down, and he said, like, okay, all done, goodbye, and like kissed him and left the room. And Aaron wasn't like really awake for that, but I just remember thinking like, oh, I think today's the day. And Ralph is 9 now, and I'm remarried, and he has siblings, which, you know, I said I was going to have 4 kids. I got them through alternate means. He has siblings, and he has, you know, he has Matthew, my husband, who he calls Maddie Daddy, or depending on the screen time rules that are being handed down, just Matt, which I'm like, woof, it's cold. cold. Or Dad sometimes. And Ralph also has, I think now that he is 9, but even at age 7, even at like age 5, he looks so much like his dad, Michael. He acts so much like him. He has like these crazy mannerisms that could only be like, there's no way a 2-year-old could remember like how his dad crossed his legs or how his dad like rolled his eyes at me, you know, or like would say like, this weird little shoulder thing, all these things. And I think he really loves to be told that he reminds me of his dad. And it also really hurts him that he doesn't have any of his own memories. And I think that is a thing that I've learned about kids and grief, is that they grieve at milestones too. So starting kindergarten was really emotional for him because his dad wasn't there. And you know, the pandemic, when, you know, these kids were overhearing, by the way, all of us being like, I don't know, I think everyone's going to die. Yeah, just like, don't breathe in and like, don't touch your groceries. You know, he's like, he's very afraid of me dying. Like that is, he's very, very afraid of that. I don't go out a lot. Like we got to go out last night, but it required like hours of me being like, and we're going to go to dinner and your sister's going to put you to sleep. And then when you get home, I will put a note next to your bed that tells you, that proves that I came in and like,
here,
you know, and I returned.
I'm familiar with these kinds of tactics.
Right. And it's like, I think that, and he'll feel differently about it when he is 13 or when he's 18 or when he is, you know, 31, the age his dad was when he got sick, or when he's 35, the age his dad was when he died. And so I didn't think, you know, oh, you know, good thing he's so little. I thought like, oh, he's so little, you know, but yeah. I mean, I did hear people say stuff to me like, well, it's a good thing he's so little because, you know, he won't have to feel sad. And I'm like, are you familiar with being a person?
I do think there's so much of that, like, it's a good thing, .. where you're like, oh, I think you could shut up, actually.
Like,
I know you're trying to be nice, but you could shut up.
Yeah, it's a good thing he won't remember. It's like,
when you talk about him, you know, feeling sad that he doesn't have those memories with his dad, do you, like, is that something you try to fix in some way? I feel like that's like a, you know, sort of an instinct as a parent when your child is like, I don't have this thing that other kids have. Mm-hmm. You're like, I absolutely cannot give it to you. It is impossible, but I will try to do this. Is there something that you've tried?
Yeah, I can't. There's nothing I can do because he's too smart. And he pointed out when he was in kindergarten, I have memories you gave me, you know, and the memories that he does have that are his are from that day. He's like, they came and they brought like, the doctors came to our house, right? And like, well, it wasn't doctors, but they were two nurses, right? Who like come to prove the body's dead, I guess. They're like, right. Yep, you didn't fake it.
Oh,
yeah. You know what you got on your hands? You got a dead body. Okay.
This is for sure a dead person.
This is. And you know it's your husband? Okay, well, we're going to verify. Okay? We don't want any switcheroos.
Fantastic. Sign here. Okay, we'll see you.
Yeah. Like, so he remembers that, but he doesn't really have any other memories. And some days he does have sort of like an appetite to like look through photos of when he was a baby, or, you know, even I have all of his dad's iPhoto archives, right? So photos of Aaron from before I even knew him. And sometimes he does want to look through that stuff. And sometimes he just, he does not. But no, I really try as much as possible to just let him be sad about the thing he's sad about instead of trying to offer him an alternative that's not as good. You know, is Pepsi okay? No. Like, okay. Like, I know you don't remember it yet, but do you want to see a photo of him playing you in a swaddle like an electric guitar? Like, because I thought that was so smart and funny.
Yeah, that sounds like an emotionally healthy approach to that.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see when he grows up and can write his own memoirs, I guess.
Did your dad's death and also the miscarriage prior to your dad dying, it's every kind of family grief sort of within such a short period of time.
Yeah.
How were those deaths, the grief of those deaths, how was it different?
Oh, just ignored totally. Like, I got a DNC and went to Aaron's last art show the day that I had a miscarriage. So, you know, and just stood there smiling and bleeding and not telling anybody what was happening. And I felt like I just broke the world and Aaron's like last chance at happiness. And then I just didn't feel it at all. I just completely compartmentalized it. And my dad dying, I had a couple minutes to sort of feel that. And I think the complication of that and the fact that I also went completely untreated by any mental health professional for so long that when I did get treated, it was for PTSD. it was for, you know, all the ways that these things had sort of tangled inside of me. Because also, as much as it was, you know, oh, I just don't need therapy, I got this far without it, and what's someone going to tell me that I'm sad? No shit. It was also completely like an access issue. And I am like a middle class, like white lady, but I couldn't fucking go in the middle of the day to see a therapist. I had a kid and also I had no job. So I'd also lost my insurance. So also it's just, there were all these sort of layers or barriers, even to somebody in my position. And the depth of all of these losses, as much as I tried to be the world's fastest griever, you know, the peregrine falcon of grief, right? I'm just going to feel it fast and then I'll be done and I will be the best griever anyone has ever seen. Like, I didn't understand how much the miscarriage affected me until I was pregnant again with Matthew. And I was completely unhinged. Like, Michael, I didn't tell anyone I was pregnant, like, at all. Like, I mean, I told Matthew, I told like some parts of our family, maybe like one or two friends, and then I just pretended I wasn't pregnant.
Did other people know that you had miscarried?
Yeah, like by that point, like I had, you know, the only way I could sort of process it was through writing, and so I'd written about it, but then also just been like, okay, so I cried while I was writing that, and that's good, I'm done. You know, like that's sad, yeah. And then also that's it. And I mean, it was so I wouldn't have to really even, I was so afraid that if I made it a real thing, that something bad would happen and I would lose the pregnancy. And then it was just so unhealthy. I was so nuts. I have no idea how Matthew and I survived that, frankly.
And I think, I mean, that the way you describe, like, having miscarried and then just like, okay, I've got other stuff mm-hmm. to do today. And just like kind of going about your day. And the few people I've talked to about miscarriage, it seems like a very common thing where it's like,
I think so, yeah.
There's like a mix of obviously the grief of it happening, but also kind of being like, well, then it really, like, is this even, am I even allowed to feel grief about this? Like how, you know, you're basing on how far along you are to sort of like do the science of how alive this person was. And it's a topic that I think is so, just like the people who suffer it are so underserved in like any kind of dialogue.
Well, yeah, because at least you know you can get pregnant. You know, like
right.
at least
yes.
you. It's a good thing it happened 11 weeks and 6 days. Because if you had been second trimester, I think it would have been sadder. If you had waited one day, you know, I think you'd be even sadder.
Yeah.
It's just.
And people did say stuff like that, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. It felt like a task. It felt like a task. And I think I would have let myself be sad about it. But I literally had to, I was like, I can't do this right now. Like, I can't do this right now because my dad's in an ICU on the other side of town. So we have to do this now so I can go and be with my dad who's about to die. And then my dad died and I wasn't going to be at the funeral. Like, also, there was another thing.
Right.
Just quick, while I have everyone's attention, one of us is actually sadder than the other. Okay.
Not that it's a competition or anything.
Not that it's a competition, but it's me and Aaron. We're the saddest ones here. Thank you. Thank you. Enjoy your ham sandwich.
Since it's 2014, right?
Yeah. Which feels like so long ago sometimes. And sometimes I'm like, yeah. 2014, baby.
Mm. How has the grief changed?
It will always be sad. This will always be sad. It will always be sad that my dad died when he was 62. That's like, you know, that's youngish. That's a young grandpa. Okay. That's a young old person. And it will always be sad that I don't have a first grader right now. You know, like there's a missing first grader somewhere out there. And they're mine. And it will always, always, always be sad that Aaron died when he was 35 and that Ralph doesn't have his dad and that Aaron's mom doesn't have her son and his sister doesn't have her only brother. Like, there's not a world where that isn't sad. I don't wake up every day like this, but I still have access to this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course.
And especially at certain times, all this happened in the fall. I moved climates. I have to say that helps because the feeling of Minnesota fall, like on the air in early August, I would just like start to collapse into myself. And then October would come and I'd be like, oh, and then November would come and I would just be wrecked. And this past year, I happened to be in a cold climate, like 2 days before Aaron's death anniversary. And I just had a full-on breakdown in a hotel room, and I did what anyone would do, which I thought, would this be good podcast content? And I just recorded myself just like thinking out loud about all this bawling. And I got an email from a person who I think meant well, who is like, you know, I can help you, like, I can help you heal that. And I just thought, heal, like what? I think it's okay for that still to hurt.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as though I'm walking around unable to engage with the world. It's not as though I spend, you know, my days and my entire life in a mausoleum dedicated to Aaron, but this is a formative part of who I am. And I think his life and his love are worth missing. I think that's okay. Like, I think it would actually be really weird if I could do these kinds of interviews and just tell you a story with complete emotional remove. Wouldn't that make you feel weird, Michael? What would you even call the podcast? Like, good, not
just,
crying.
Just hanging out, gone.
A good hang.
For me, you know, my son died in 2009. I think when it happened, it was like totally, utterly debilitating. And then, you know, so you cry every day. Mm-hmm. And then gradually you're crying 3 times a week. And then you're crying once a week. And then you cry once a month. And now I'm knocked down by it less and less. Like, it's very rare that I'll have a day where it's like, oh boy, I'm going to have to lay down, I think, this whole day.
Yeah.
But the sadness, and I've said this on this podcast a bunch, but I feel it. I miss it. So, like, it feels good every once mm-hmm. in a while. To be like, oh man, I miss my son. I wish he were here right now. And to just sit down and be like, I'm just gonna let this come over me.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it feels good a little bit.
Yeah. I remember when Aaron died, a family friend had lost their dad to the same cancer. I actually had to cancel my first date with Aaron to go to their dad's funeral. It was a night funeral, which I stole that idea when Aaron died. It was like night funeral. Chic. Beautiful.
Chic.
Elegant. past hors d'oeuvres. I couldn't afford hors d'oeuvres. It was just alcohol, and I blacked out. I was like, feed yourselves. It does start at 7. Like, you should know there won't be dinner. I got, like, brownies from Costco. That's it, baby.
BYO sandwiches.
You can, like, this is before Uber Eats or anything, too. So I was like, I don't know. I order in a pizza, I guess. I don't know what you're going to do, but maybe not. I don't think that, like, goes with the aesthetic. But I had this friend, her dad died of the same cancer, and then her brother died, like, a year later. 2 years later, it doesn't matter. It was like these two huge foundational relationships gone. And I remember her saying to me, like, you're going to miss this level of pain because it's what you were describing, that getting knocked down is like this sense that, like, you're still so close to the version of your son who is alive. Hmm. You know? Like, the closer you are to it, like, the easier it is to remember, right? Like, remember, like, you know, that the shape of their nose, or, like, you know, their ear, all these little things about a person that eventually sort of, like, just get replaced with the memory of a photograph instead. And I remember her telling me that, and it made immediate sense to me. It really did. I wasn't like, oh, I won't miss this. I was like, oh no, I think I will miss this. I think this is a pain that's worth having. And you're right. It does sometimes, like, feel good. And it also just feels good to be, like, asked to talk about him too. Like, you asked me, like, what are your favorite memories? And now all day my brain is going to serve up, like, memories. You know what I mean?
Here's another good one. Yeah.
Like, you know, like him playing Ralph like an electric guitar. That was so funny. Like, he started doing this thing when, like, Ralph was, like, a little baby, where he would, like, pretend to be really mad at him. You know, and he'd be like, you gotta get your life together. What are you doing? And Ralph would, like, lose his mind laughing. Like, he'd be like, don't laugh at me. I'm being serious. Like, you gotta get over here. And, like, Ralph couldn't crawl. He was like, you gotta get your gross motor skills up to speed. like just shit talking this little baby who thought it was the funniest thing in the world. Like, forgot about that. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about how your loss is carried forward into your new marriage. Like, I've never talked with anybody about that. Is that something you feel okay talking about?
Yeah. It's so natural. People are so fascinated by that. And I fully get it, because I would be too. And I never had, like, a real safe kind of love until I had Aaron. You know, everything was always very jealous, very possessive, very just, like, insecure constantly. And once you have, like, a very, very good love, you can never accept anything except that. You just can't. There's just, or at least I can't. There are probably some exceptions out there, but the standard had been set so high. And Matthew is not a widower, but he is divorced. And he had gone through his own stuff. And I knew that when I met him. I didn't know that, but I just knew, like, oh, here's a person who has survived something. Here's a person who has his own sense of who he is. We met through a mutual friend who was also a widow, who was sort of, like, trying to matchmake us and trick us into meeting each other. But Matthew never Googled me, ever. And so he let me just tell him the story, and he let me experience my grief, because I met him a year after Aaron died. And would you believe I was not better? And I don't think that I experienced the depth of what I lost with Aaron until I had Matthew and, like, this safe place to sort of, like, exist with that loss. And some of our first dates were just me being like, oh, I'm glad you're here. I was just reading Mary Oliver poems and crying. Can I continue? And him being like, do you need me to just, like, rub your back quietly and then shovel the walk and leave? Yeah, that is what I need. It is. Thank you. But we have this blended family, which also means that we have one child that we created together, which means that we have three kids who had another version of a family. You know, like, three kids who also experienced very big loss. And I think the best thing that we can do for kids, for other people, is model for them that you are allowed to miss what you had and love what you have. And those things aren't at odds with each other at all. But I will say, Matthew is unusual. Our relationship is unusual. It is unusual that Aaron's mom and Matthew's mom are friends and have their own little relationship. Like, they hang out without me. I find that beautiful and rude. And like, I would also like to get lunch in the middle of the day. Like, just because I'm not retired doesn't mean I don't want to act like it. And, you know, our families are all going to have Easter together. And that's very unusual. That's very unusual. A lot of times, widows, in-laws, like, will feel like threatened by that, or will feel replaced, or will feel like scared. Who knows? Like
sure.
every person you know feels like scared and small and insecure at some point. And love is supposed to kind of give us the opposite thing. And I do know a lot of people who weren't so lucky with their second relationship or their next relationship after being widowed. And a person was like, well, God, I don't want to, you know, compete with a dead person. It's like, well, if you think that's what you're doing, then you already lost, right? Like, then you already lost. But I have this joke that I delivered on TikTok, and it was like set to one of those dumb little dances, which is like questions I get about being a remarried widow. And it's like, but you're remarried. And like, oh, isn't your new husband jealous? And it's like, yeah, he would rather be dead than be married to me. Like, what? Like, what kind of, like, what is he? Yeah, of course. Of course he's jealous. Like, oh, he can't wait to be, you know, just a ghost. He can't wait. He can't wait. So, and yet I get it. I get it. You know, a dead person never forgets to take out the trash. Right. You know, a dead person never disagrees with you. Like, a dead person does get to sort of be a, like, the best version of themselves. And I'm not deifying Aaron. He literally just was that good. Like, we just really had a good marriage. You know, like, his one flaw, the only one thing that I can remember arguing about is that, like, he joked around too much.
Yeah, which in the scheme of things is a pretty good one.
Yeah, right. In the whole scheme of things. And it's like, also, so did I. You know, and he'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, I was continuing your joke. I was like, right, but like, you took it too far. So, like, right, but you got more attention for it, and therefore I didn't
like
it.
And that is mean.
That is unkind. I don't like it. I don't need to put up with this. And Matthew's so wonderful too. You know, like, I am two for two. Did that answer your question? I don't know. I know it's interesting to people. I know people want to be like, but isn't he fucking jealous, right? Or like, doesn't he feel weird that like, you, when you listen to Cardigan by Taylor Swift, you just sobbed because Aaron wore cardigans, and you do believe that Taylor Swift knows that and wrote a song about your dead husband, like, for you? Yeah, he probably does think that's weird, but also he was like, okay. Oh, is that the kind of day you're having? Okay.
Awesome.
All right. You need me to get the kids from school? Okay. Okay. You know?
Yeah, I guess like my preconception of what it would be like doesn't really exist. It's more just that I don't know anything about it. And everything that I don't know about, I'm like, I'm the stupidest possible person. So I'm just curious about the, you know, the things that people... Well, like, I wouldn't even know what questions to ask about what would make that relationship different.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, there's like the obvious sort of assumption that, well, if you love this guy, you're obviously not sad about the other guy anymore. And I don't know about you, but like, my grief has been mixed into all kinds of situations and feelings. Yes. You know, if we go back to that smoothie, like, it is, you know, it's the unflavored protein powder. It can really go with anything. It assumes the flavor of whatever, you know, whatever it's added to. But I know, what else are people curious about? I mean, it's basically like, well, but how does he feel? Like, how does he feel? And I always like to speak for men. That's very important.
It's been a life goal of yours.
Yes. I don't want him to have his own, like, you know, opinions, thoughts, feelings. But we had a conversation once, and I've invited him on my podcast, and he's just like, oh, no, I'm good. No, I'm good.
I'm fine. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. I'm good. I'm good. I'm really busy. But he was like, well, yeah, sometimes I just feel guilty, right? Like, I feel bad. Like, I feel bad that I'm here and Aaron's not. Like, that makes me sad. He was a good guy, and I'm sad that he's dead. Like, Matthew has his own relationship with Aaron too, which is, he's like, it's a big responsibility. He's like, to raise, you know, a son that somebody else created and would have really liked to be here for. He's like that. He's like, I take that very seriously, and I wouldn't be with somebody who didn't. But I think what I love so much about Matthew is, like, he really is so genuine. And he and Aaron have so much in common and the absolute opposite personalities. Like, Aaron was the life of the party. Matthew will be at the party for a brief amount of time. And, like, you'll find a quiet spot to post up if you engage him in conversation. Great. If you don't, he's also fine. He could wipe down some surfaces. He could clear,
yeah,
he'd clear
he's
a
there
table.
If you need him.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. He will be a life at the party. But
okay. Thank you for entertaining my tedious curiosity.
Yeah. No, it wasn't at all. I know people are curious about it. Now I can't even remember the things that, like, people ask about, but it's, I think people are always worried, like, Matthew doesn't get enough, you know, like, what about that guy?
Right, right, right. That, like, Aaron will be like an elephant in the room all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, well, no, like, I do think of Aaron every day. Like, every day he crosses my mind. We have a child together. I think that's very normal. Mm-hmm. But it's not as though every moment that Matthew and I are together, I'm like, just like photoshopping Aaron's face over him mentally or something.
Right.
You know, like, Matthew is his own, like, good thing. And we have our own, like, relationship and story. And he's the main character in this iteration of my life.
You mentioned the idea as a joke of Matthew being jealous of Aaron being a ghost. Do you think of Aaron as being a ghost or, like, as being someplace?
Sometimes. Like, don't you sometimes feel like just like a love?
Yes.
Right?
I absolutely, and I don't, yeah. For me, like, logically, I don't intend to feel that. I'm like, of course not.
Yeah.
But there will be times where you're like, that shirt's folded weird. Something's up with the shirt. Like that. Yeah. I think that's my son there.
Yeah. Or, like, people always think birds are their people. And mm-hmm. I was trying to explain it to Ralph, who has no religious affiliation at all. And is just like, he's like, well, heaven's not real. I'm like, okay, but, you know, for some people it is. Like, be respectful, you know? He's like, oh, yeah, no, I mean, for some people, like, for sure. But, like, just, like, come on. he's like, right, like, Santa. Like, come on. Which he also never believed in. Like, he also, like, from the get-go, he was like, unlikely. No. No. I tried to explain to Ralph is, like, I think, like, you just are sort of everywhere. Like, you're just everywhere all the time. And sometimes that is, like, a more acute, like, feeling. Like, sometimes if I'm super keyed up, like, I can feel Aaron being like, shut the fuck up. You know, like, lovingly, like, shh, like, what? Like, what if you said nothing? Like, what if you didn't react? Like, what if you just stopped? Like, what if you, let it go? Because he was so chill. And he was like, if there were a procedural TV drama comedy made about your life, it would be called Nora Petty. He's like, maybe Nicole Petty. We'd have changed the front name. And you'd be an officer who only investigated petty crimes. Like,
but treated them like murders.
You'd be like, no, that person took a left on a red arrow. And we are going to find them. And and they will hear.
Yeah.
Why that was incorrect. And they will apologize to the person who had the right of way. Thank you.
Yeah, and that will be punishment enough for them. They will wish they had gone, they'd wish they'd had life in prison.
Oh, God. But I don't know. Sometimes I think it's, I don't know. It's not like a ghost, but I do think, like, I mean, I was there when Aaron died and I thought it would be so scary, you know, or just, but there was this moment where, like, I knew it before I knew it. And I, like, felt it. And I felt, like, that presence. And it felt like everything in the universe made sense, right? Like you are joining everything, like you are everything. It was so peaceful and so beautiful. And it was one of those moments, and you have them so, I have them so infrequently where it's like, I get it. Like I get it. And then catch me in the Home Depot parking lot like 2 weeks later being like, that was my spot. You will return the cart. Just like.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, everything matters. And I'll tell you why.
That's so true. That feeling of like, oh, I've been given access to a special knowledge because of my pain. Yes. And then also someone just cut me off in traffic and I'm going to kill them.
And what they don't know is that like I lose access to that regularly. I lose access to that special knowledge. And now I'm just a monster again. Now I'm just another monster like we all are.
Just Another Monster.
Yeah.
Great name. It's a great name for a sitcom. Mm. Not a sitcom. One of those like HBO things that's like happy, but also sad. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, first of all, thank you for spending this much time with me. You're the best. I wanted to ask you, for the people who listen to this podcast who are, you know, going through stuff on their own now, if you could talk to yourself at that time when Aaron died, is there like advice you would give to that person or anything you would say that you think could help her handle it better?
Yeah. And she would have been like, shut up. I don't listen to anyone
she
ever.
Would have not received it.
No, she would have been like, decline. Okay. Someone gave me a book when Aaron died called Jesus Calling. And I was like, sends to voicemail. No. I need literally nothing. And I would tell her, I was so afraid, Michael, of being seen as a sad story because I could see what it did to Aaron, right? When he got sick, it wasn't like, oh, like this are funny. Like it just was like, oh, do you hear it? It's so sad. Yeah. And I hated that, like just flattened him out into this cancer story. And I just didn't want anyone to feel bad for me. And so I just, like, there's a reason why my podcast is called Terrible Thanks for Asking. And that's because I was such a fucking liar, especially in those first few months. I was like, I am so good. Thank you so much for asking how I am at my husband's funeral. I've literally never been better. Look at me. Okay.
What an astute question. I'm doing great.
First of all, so glad you brought that up. I'm obviously thriving. I'm wearing white wool in December. So I think you can tell that I've got it together. I am drunk to the point of like unconsciousness in public. And I'm about to be kicked out of a karaoke bar where I believe you can't get kicked out, like even if you've stabbed someone. So yeah, I'd say I'm doing pretty well. And that was just such a problem because it made me so lonely. And all of the people who loved me the most, who weren't going to judge me, right? Who were not going to turn this into like, and minimize me into just being like a sad, unemployed, widowed mom. Like they needed the right information to show up. And I gave them bad information. And then I was upset with them for not showing up when I had specifically told them, I've got it. You don't need to show up. Like it's mind-boggling now, but it really did make perfect sense at the time. At the time, I was like, I'm just going to do this on my own and I will get through it. And it will not involve, you know, my sister who has a husband and children and her own life coming to my house and laying in bed with me. She's got her own stuff. This one's mine. I got this one. She can do something else. And it's like, she would have loved to have done that. You know what I mean? Like she would have loved to do that.
I really do think that's something people don't know, which is that the people who love you want to be there for you. Like it makes that, it makes us, them feel good when like the person who is going through something calls upon you to be like, I think you could help me.
Yeah. It's an honor. It is an honor to be a person who is needed and who can be relied on. And it's not an imposition. And anybody who makes you feel like it is just not the right person. And all you are doing when you reach out to somebody and they say the wrong thing is you're gathering information. You are learning who is that inner circle for this experience and who's not. And it doesn't mean that those people who couldn't show up, who I burned those bridges so hard and so fast, right? Like, they weren't bad people, couldn't tell me that at the time, right? I was like, you suck, you're terrible, see you in hell, I'll save you a seat. Just horrible, like just scorch the earth. Like, they also were doing the best they could. And not everybody is equipped to be like your personal, you know, valet through grief. And that's okay. That's okay. And the people who show up, even if they're unexpected, even if they're slightly annoying, even if they're not what you wanted, like, they are the right people. Those are the people.
Nora, thank you so much. This was another episode of A Good Cry with Nora McInerney. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps. See you next season. A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Edited and mixed by Caitlin Moldenhauer.
That was a HeadGum podcast.